It was suggested that we begin with the responsibility pledge. Do you know that? Always to extend the hand of OA to all who share my compulsion for this, I am responsible. So let's begin with that. Always to extend the hand of OA to those who share my compulsion. For this, I am responsible. I think it's very apt to use that responsibility pledge because it is what we are here for. When you think about Overeaters Anonymous or any 12-step fellowship and the history of AA and 12-step fellowships, 12-step fellowship, we reach step 12 and we have to help someone else. We have to give it away in order to keep what we have. What's the most efficient way of doing that? You have a fellowship. And that's how AA started. It didn't start by saying, let's create a fellowship and people will come. It started by two guys, Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob, who said, we've got to give this away or else we can't keep it. And they actively sought out people to carry the message to. And around the people who heard that message and recovered using it, a fellowship developed. That eventually, when the book Alcoholics Anonymous was published, began to be called Alcoholics Anonymous. It didn't have a name until the book was published. I'm Laurie. I'm a compulsive reader.
Hi,
I understand there's some people who weren't here last night, and I want to give a general overview of what I talked about. For those of you who weren't here yesterday, you missed the most brilliant thing you've ever heard in your entire life. I mean, the standing ovation I got, right, was, about 20 minutes long. It was, I've never spoken so more eloquently. Just to bring us up to date, we're talking about the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. It was called the big book. Affectionately, because the first edition was sold for $3, which in 1939 was a lot of money. And they decided to give alcoholics a sense that they were getting something of great value. They would print it on the cheapest, thickest paper possible. So you can buy from Alcoholics Anonymous a reproduction, a replica of the first edition. And it's much thicker than the one that we get now, even though it has approximately the same number of pages and all that. So it was affectionately called the Big Book. And as I said yesterday, it has become for many of us in OA an understandable set of directions for working the steps. It was the first set of directions. It was designed for people who had heard of AA, but who did not know how to work the program, and were in cities and towns other than Akron, Cleveland, and New York, which was where the first approximately 100 people were. So they decided, the fellowship decided, it's a long and interesting history, and I recommend there's a book there called Pass It On, the History of Bill Wilson, and Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, two AA histories, which are, they're sort of the official and slightly laundered versions of these guys' lives, but it gives the general history of AA, and it's fascinating. But at any rate, the fellowship, a very small fellowship, decided to have a book written that would carry the message to those who still suffered, who did not have access to a member of AA. People were sponsoring or helping others in many different ways, but they had to find a way to carry the message by reading and not through individual contact. And they all agreed that the book that eventually became the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, was a proper medium of carrying that message, a proper way of doing that. It contains directions. I read it for 6 or 7 years in a way without sort of understanding those directions. As well, because the big book was written by white Christian males who had been middle class and lost absolutely everything in disastrous consequences, it stems from their experience and doesn't always speak to women, doesn't always speak to victims. It doesn't always speak to non-Christian males, white males. And so it needs, even though the directions are there, it really needs some sort of twisting and turning to understand how those directions would apply to a lot of us. And the book you have that was given to you is a book I wrote a number of, I'm still sort of revising it every so often, but it's a book that tries to be what you call a gloss or an interpretation of the big book as it applies to OA, to members of OA. And I hope it's of some value. It contains a lot of things, and I'm very careful to say and to acknowledge that almost none of it is original. I got it from a lot of AA speakers, four in particular, whom I give credit to, and the experience of a lot of OAers who have helped me so much in the process. So I've just put something together. And as we go through it, you'll see in the book there are forms that were developed by an AA guy in my hometown for doing step four, the big book way. There are different sort of documents that might be of assistance to you, and I'll refer to many of them as we go on. So yesterday I talked at length, told my story, but I also talked at length about the beginning of the big book and the brilliant analysis of the problem of alcoholism that came from the mind of Dr. William Silkworth, who was a neurologist, a neurosurgeon, and psychologist, all combined, as I understand it, who had worked with 50,000 drunks, most of them sort of middle to upper class, who could afford during the Depression to be put into a dryout facility, which he ran. And he wasn't very successful, even though he really worked hard and his heart was absolutely in it. I mean, he was called the little man who loved drunks. He was a sort of a short guy. And he had come up with a theory that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 1931 or 32, and that just didn't take off. No one accepted this theory. To this day, people don't accept it because it's not really scientifically measurable. But his theory was that alcoholics have something abnormal about their bodies as well as their minds. It wasn't just a mind problem of sort of like push yourself away from the table or, you know, it's just a matter of won't power. I can't tell you how many times I've heard that in my life. That alcoholics had a trigger in them that when they started to ingest alcohol, the body wanted more. Whereas normal people, when they ingest alcohol, they reach a point at which they don't want any more. Their bodies are full. And I have that with alcohol. I can't drink much alcohol, but I've never had that with food, certain foods. I've had it with radishes. I certainly have been full of radishes in my life. But there are, although you mix radishes with a very creamy dressing, and I'm sure I can eat radishes. If you force me. So his theory was that there were two problems that the alcoholic had that created a vicious circle. The first problem was once they started, they couldn't stop. And you know, as time got on, it got worse with them. There were times when you could stop. There were times when the alcoholics could stop and not go back again for quite some time. Maybe early on in their drinking careers. But at a certain point, they reach this level where they need it. And that is abnormal. It's not the same. He called that an allergy because the word allergy in those days meant a detrimental reaction to a substance. And the detrimental, the bad reaction to alcohol for them was what he called the phenomenon of craving. A phenomenon is an unexplained occurrence. And he didn't know how it happened or why it happened, but alcoholics developed this intense craving that overpowered their ability to say no, overpowered their minds, and they couldn't stop. And it's the same as you can't control your breathing. You can for minutes, depending on your fitness and your training, but for more, I don't know what the world's record is for holding the breath, but maybe 5 minutes or something, but beyond that, maybe 10. I don't know if some of those pearl divers evidently can hold their breath for quite a long time. For me, it's a minute, no more, maybe even less than that. And at a certain point, the body says, I need oxygen. Give it to me. And you breathe. Same with your heart. You can't control your heart very easily. You can keep your eyes open, for only so long, and sooner or later your body's going to say, I need to blink. So that's this, the image that those aren't the doctor's image, but that's the concept that the doctor had, that the body took over and overpowered the ability of the mind to control. If that were the only problem, however, that would not be a problem for sane people, because sane people, knowing that a substance would give them a bad reaction, this craving, would simply say, well, then why would I indulge in it? If I know that drinking is going to cause me all these horrible things, all the bad effects, if I know that eating foods would cause me all the bad effects that they have caused me in my life, why in the world would I do that? Why would I indulge in these things? Sane people ask that question. And sane people looked at me and said, you know you're killing yourself. Why are you doing this? Why don't you just say no? And the real answer is, even if I've dieted and my body no longer needs this stuff, I've really gone cold turkey, as it were, sometimes literally, my body's no longer saying, give me more. My real problem is that I have an abnormal mind as well. I'm going to talk about that quite a bit this morning. My abnormal mind gives me reasons to go back. They're all stupid reasons. Some are insane, some are emotional, but every one of them is stupid because there's never an answer in going back to the food. It creates more problems, clearly. But at a certain point, there's a little click and you say, yeah, I'll have some. So I'll talk about that a little bit more. But I want to finish up the analysis. In OA, OA is an umbrella fellowship. Unlike some of the other food addict fellowships, and I'm only going to apologize once for those who weren't here yesterday. I'm coming off pneumonia. I'm still coughing. I'm not contagious. And I know people told me the coughing doesn't bother them that much. So I'm very happy for that. It bothers me, but I'm still coughing. I had a great sleep last night. I thought that would solve the issue, but it didn't. I'm still coughing, but I'm taking cough drops. Even though I'm not supposed, I don't eat between meals, and I don't suck or chew between meals, I make an exception when I'm sick. So I am sucking cough drops and stuff like that. So I want to go back. OA is this umbrella fellowship. Unlike AA, unlike NA, unlike GA, where you walk into those fellowships and they say, stop indulging in the thing that is killing you. You know that. I mean, you know. You go to AA, don't drink, do the steps, you'll recover, you won't want to drink again. Stop gambling, stop taking narcotics or whatever it is that, you know. In OA, we have agreed, our group conscience of OA has agreed, and you'll find this both in our revised second edition of the OA 12 and 12 and in the pamphlet A Dignity of Choice and in other parts of the program, that someone else's list of things to abstain from is not necessarily and should not be automatically your list. That you have to work it yourself. And I talked yesterday at some length about the analysis that I do for myself and continue to do. I'm always watchful of things that I become too attached to, and I wonder whether maybe I shouldn't be having those things. And I do an analysis, and I sometimes say, no, these are bad for me. These are things that create cravings in me, even though I didn't realize it. And sometimes I say, no, they're not bad for me, and it's not that bad, and I'm not going to give them up. So I'm still watchful all the time. But there's an analysis, and I talk about what I do with my sponsees. And I had some comments about that. I also had two questions, and here's the ask it basket. We can't sort of have conversations in such a large crowd. And for those on the recording, you should know that the crowd is about 2,000. I don't know why you're laughing. but at any rate, there's an ask it basket there. If you have any questions or concerns or discussions or anything, just put it there. I'll be happy to talk about it at a time when it's appropriate. I mean, you may ask me a question that I would rather talk about when I get to step 11, but I don't, you know, so I won't answer your questions immediately. I have two questions. Someone said, you said when I was in OA, and the question mark. Well, I don't know, I don't remember saying that, but if I did, I misspoke. I've been in OA since 1986, so someone sort of seemed to get the impression that I got out of OA or something, but I'm not. I'm in OA. I'm an OA member. I'm quite active in OA. Someone said, and I think I understand this, in the first step, first edition OA, it clearly states, We thought, quote, we thought when we lost all our weight, we thought our problems would be gone. How does that reflect working the steps, especially since you lose the weight and have not finished the steps? Wouldn't it be more plausible to be happy, serene, working the program, still be heavy? Maybe. So there's a difference between therapy and the 12 steps. Okay? And there's a difference, and that difference is some people need therapy. Some people need counseling. Some people need all kinds of things to help them cope with the world. That has, in a sense, nothing and everything to do with why we join this program and what we need out of it. We certainly did think that when we lost all our weight, this is before OA, that our problems would be solved. And as I told you, I reached my goal weight in a what they call a weigh and pay commercial weight loss program 3 times. And each time I looked great and I thought all my problems were solved, and none of them were solved. You know? So yeah, we did think that it was only the weight, but it wasn't, for me at any rate, and it wasn't for, I know for lots of you, because I've had discussions with this. And the whole point of the sentence that was quoted was, no, our problems had to be solved by a power greater than ourselves. We had to find an answer through the 12 steps for us. The question seems to imply to me, can you be serene and happy and still be fat? There are lots of people in this world who maybe, I mean, certainly I was never fat and serene and happy, but there may be people who reach a level of serenity and happiness without the 12 steps. They just have that. God bless them, is what I say. They might not need the program. The other element of this, though, is that if you work the steps and you still are overweight or desperately underweight, whatever your particular eating problems are, how can you do step 12? That's the real question. You know, when you talk a good talk but you aren't walking a good walk, then you're hurting the people who come to OA looking for the thing that OA promises, which is freedom from the bondage of food. And I take that responsibility really seriously. I told the story about how I had discovered the Big Book, and I was working with another guy who lost all of his weight, but I hadn't lost my weight, but I was abstinent, and I was working on the steps, and I wanted to sponsor. And he and I discussed this. How could I sponsor, even though I'm serene and happy, if I'm still heavy? And I said to myself, I have a responsibility to look good for the people I need to help people. I like the 12 steps. You need to help them. You can't keep what you've got unless you give it away. This has all been sort of resolved by the group conscience of OA, which has changed the definition of abstinence to include working toward and maintaining a healthy body weight. Not normal body weight, but a healthy body weight. Whatever that means between you and your doctor, between you and you. But it requires honesty. And so, within OA, it is impossible to say that you are abstinent if you aren't working towards and maintaining a healthy body weight. That doesn't mean you have to be thin or a healthy body weight to carry the message. But it does mean you have to be conscious of what you look like for those who still suffer. I'll give you a couple of examples. Roseanne, our founder, the last major speech she gave at the World Service Business Conference, she came and she said, I know I am heavier than I was when I last spoke to you. I want to explain to you why I am still abstinent, and that is because I have cancer, I've been taking chemotherapy, my complete digestive system has broken down. I have lowered my calorie level to the lowest point my doctor will allow me to keep it for my health. And I have gained weight. I cannot lose this weight. I want you to know that because I am still, I don't think she worded it this way, but she was still an example of having been absent for many, many years in this program. I met a few people in OA who were tremendously morbidly obese, who would say at a meeting, I know what I still look like, but I want to tell you I've lost 100 pounds and I'm losing, you know, X number of pounds a day or a week or a month or whatever. One guy, morbidly obese, a Big Book thumper, I met him and he said, my doctor has told me that for my health I cannot lose more than a pound a month. It is so frustrating to lose only a pound a month. But he said, I am working the program. So it doesn't mean you have to have reached the healthy body weight, but it means you have to be conscious of the impression you give to those who still suffer. Because the primary purpose of an OA meeting is to carry the message of recovery through the 12 steps to those who still suffer. And if you have to contribute to that message, and it's important. So my answer to the person who wrote, there is this concept in OA of fat serenity. It's kind of a denigrating phrase, I suppose, but it's this concept of saying, I love what these meetings do for me. I feel loved. I feel comfortable. It's spiritual, emotional, and physical, and I've got the spiritual part, and I've got the emotional part, and the physical will come. I'm controversial. I know that, but some of the things I say can be controversial. But I have to tell you that is self-directed. It's sort of like I'm good, but think of those who still suffer. And if you aren't thinking of those who still suffer, what does step 12 mean to you? Because step 12 means that I'm outside of myself. I can't live with me. I can't live rent-free in my mind, right? I mean, my mind is still, after many, many years, after almost 25 years of abstinence, my mind is not a place I should go into by myself. You know, you've heard that phrase, I guess. I need to think of others all the time. And one of the reasons I love the Big Book is that it's not very internalistic. It doesn't sort of use a lot of internal analysis and, you know, ego-id, you know, so, you know, it's just sort of practical. Stop drinking, do the steps, get on with your life and help others, and don't think of yourself. Because if you think of yourself, you have an affliction. And this is what I've come to the conclusion. I have an affliction, unlike normal people. I have a mind problem that is such that I cannot afford to indulge my wishes all the time. I have to give to others, and I don't always like that. You know, there's a lot of time I spend doing things that I would much rather listen to music or watch TV or wander or just do nothing. But I can't. And sometimes my wife does get aggravated by that, you know, by the time I spend this program. But I know that the alternative is to go back to what I used to be. So it's a disability. I mean, if I'm, there's crutches there, right? I mean, you hurt your leg, right? So, I mean, you're not suddenly going to say, oh, these crutches are just, they're unsightly, they're hurting my wrist. I'm going to get rid of them and walk. You know, you accept your disability. And if you don't accept your disability, then what are you doing? So I just want to say that. Last but not least, what I want to talk about in terms of the analysis, I've been asked by three people already to help them with their plan of eating. And I thought that one of the ways of doing this, and it's very helpful, I've done it before, is to have a little workshop on that with everyone who wants to talk about it, because really it's a joint effort. It's sort of like helping each other sort of work things out. I can ask the questions and everyone else can join in and say, well, that's true for me or that's not true for me, and sort of get a help. So I thought if it's okay with the organizers, like we finish our meal tonight around 8 o'clock, we're supposed to be back here, we could use this room, is that okay? Use this room for a workshop?
Yeah. What time?
8 o'clock, like after the meal tonight.
We are scheduled to have it until the time, like 6, I think, right? Or 5 o'clock.
No, I'm talking about after our supper.
I need to check with
people
downstairs.
Okay. If not, if there are fewer than 10 people, I've been given an executive suite.
Okay.
it's right across the hall, so we could do it there. Okay? So those I spoke to three people, and I'm happy to meet with others. So, but it's an analysis. I just want to say a few things about what I said yesterday. Someone said to me, "Well, you know, by talking about sugar and flour in such a way as I did when I said that, don't accept other fads, don't accept other people." Here I just wrote down, "Don't accept accepted wisdom." You know, because what you're going to hear in OA is a lot of people so certain about what they have to eliminate or how you should eat. And the group conscience of OA is don't accept someone else's plan of eating without doing the analysis for yourself. So I talk about flour and I say, flour, I've never met anyone who would eat a bag of flour or would eat a bag of sugar mixed with flour. And I've only met three people who would eat a bag of sugar.
Four.
Huh? Four, okay. But really, I think it's, how many people in this room would eat a bag of sugar by itself? One. That's it. Okay. Three, two. So there are some people who would eat a bag of sugar for whom sugar in any form is obviously a problem in and of itself. But sugar and flour are usually combinations of things, and it's usually the binge foods that you identify are usually combinations of sugar and flour plus fat. Usually. And I'm not suggesting that you have my problem, that's my problem. High amounts of fat in combination with sugar and in combination with salt. That's my problem. I'm not suggesting that's your problem, but I just, when I talk to people and examine them on, well, of course it's sugar, I've been sugar-free for, you know, I question them and I say, okay, well, you know, what is it? Name your binge foods. And most of the time, there's a lot of fat involved. People who eat hard candy, which is all sugar, right? I say to them, I understand that it could be the sugar in that. Could it also be the texture? Could it also be the movement of the stuff in your mouth? Is there an eating issue there, an eating behavior issue? Think about it. I'm not saying you must do this, but I ask for that analysis. As I got rid of all the fat in meat, I began to realize that meat has very little taste, because it's the fat that has a taste, and that eating meat was purely, almost purely for me, a matter of seasoning. And once I began to realize that, I also began to realize the reason I really liked meat was its chewability, its particular chewing factor. For me, I've given up meat. I still like to eat something that feels like meat, that has a chewiness of meat. So look at texture, look at your oral needs or something like that. I mean, look at sort of how you eat as well, because that's an eating behavior, that if you gave it up or you ate only at certain times, you might find that your volume would decrease, as I found. Look for combinations of ingredients and also really test yourself. Is it the bread or is it what I put on top of the bread? Is it all breads or just certain breads? You know, a good test of whether it's bread is the German thin bread that's all whole grains and seeds and stuff.
Ezekiel.
Would you, well, Ezekiel is something different, but the German bread is that very thin stuff. I don't know anyone, I mean, there may be some people who would binge on that, you know. But that's bread, you know. So you got to be careful. Then there's, you know, the sprouted breads, and then there's the deep, you know. Would you eat those without anything on them, without the peanut butter, without the jam, fat and sugar, without the honey and peanut butter, fat and sugar, you know, without the various things that you might put on the bread, the cheese, fat and salt. Is it pasta or is it the Alfredo sauce? And the cheese. I'm just thinking about these things. I'm not suggesting that you have my problem. I'm just saying that's what I think people have to think about. Okay, so I've talked about that. And it could be the texture. Like, I find myself really enjoying whole wheat spaghetti. I love the way it moves around in my mouth. Now, I don't really overeat it tremendously. I certainly don't put anything on it that creates any craving issues with me. But I'm very conscious that some things have a texture to them that can at times get to me. So I watch myself all the time because I don't want to go back to a life of cravings. Once I give in to cravings, I'll give in to everything sooner or later. So it's a matter of consciousness. And my experience is, as long as you're as honest as you can be, you start to work the steps. You get abstinent and you work the steps, and then you'll discover more as time goes on. Like, it's not a matter of you haven't been abstinent because you've been eating something that you suddenly discover creates cravings. You eliminate as soon as you discover it. You know, for 7 years of my abstinence, I would have hot air popcorn as one of my meals. I have three meals a day. It'd be one of my sort of carb. Nothing unhealthy about hot air popcorn. It's full of fiber, not many calories or anything like that. But a mentor of mine in the program said to me, after about 7 years, and I was talking about how somehow I had to finish the bowl of the popcorn, and that took precedence over everything else at the meal, because I would stop when I was full. And he said, if you find yourself unable to stop eating something, and you have to eat all of it, that you got to watch for. You got to eliminate that. So I eliminated popcorn. Having worked the steps, it wasn't hard to eliminate the popcorn. I just said, well, why would I eat that if it causes me problems? So, okay. So after around, at 8 o'clock, we'll either be meeting here or we'll be meeting in room 332, which is my room right across the hall from here.
She said it should be fine as good. Long as we don't have a raucous party.
We're not going to have a raucous party. So we'll meet here. Easier to meet here. Because out of the 2,000 people here, there must be 500 who want to do this. Okay, let's go back to the book. And we're going to start with Bill's story, very briefly. Page one. From now on, the page numbers are generally the same. Now, Bill Wilson was a hustler, a brilliant man, a guy who indulged himself in many other respects other than alcohol. His story is a story that a lot of people have trouble identifying with, and I'm not going to go through it in much detail. It's a fascinating story. It's relatively accurate. His relatively honest, based on other biographies of Bill, and it certainly has the elements that are significant. For him, he discovered booze in the First World War. He was a young recruit, and he felt part of life. He gets back from the war, he acquits himself well, he sets up in business, and he drinks with wild abandon, but enjoyment. You know, he goes to the bars, and he's a very expansive kind of guy. He's a talker. If you ever heard him speak, you'll see that. And it disturbs his wife, but he says, you know, how creative people drink. And then he starts to make tons of money. He becomes a fascinating, his story is fascinating. Somewhere on the web you can get Lois's story about this. He wrote a diary of this, the life of the hobo or something like that. Lois was his wife, co-founder of Al-Anon. He had come to the conclusion that all these stocks were being sold and bought, and no one had ever visited the factories where the companies were. He would go undercover and investigate the factories and see which had new products on the line and what might be worth investing. And he did that. And it's a fascinating story, but that's irrelevant. But he made lots and lots of money. And on page three, right in the middle, he says, you know, my judgment and ideas were followed by many to the tune of paper millions. Drink was taking an important and exhilarating part of my life. So that was part of his life. In the same way that for me, much of my life was food. I grew up, as I said, in a Jewish Russian household where the dinner table was a place you stayed at for 2 or 3 hours. Not necessarily eating all the time, but that's where the conversation was. That's where I, as a 10-year-old, was about the same height as the other people who sat around the table. And I was invited, encouraged to be part of these conversations. And my family had fascinating friends, and my grandparents, my parents. That was the center of where we sat for much of an evening. And then we'd go out to eat, and as I got older, I'd go out to eat, and we would spend time just eating and enjoying ourselves. It was an exhilarating time. We'd investigate these new restaurants and things of that sort. Then on page three, second last paragraph, my drinking assumed more serious proportions, continuing all day and almost every night. The remonstrances, warnings of my friends terminated in a row, and I became a lone wolf. So now he starts to drink alone. And I'm sure that for many of you that has some resonance, certainly has for me. Page four, the stock market crashes October, whatever it was, 1929, and people are committing suicide, jumping off the buildings. Oh, that disgusted me. I wouldn't jump. I went back to the bar. He loses everything. He a friend of his in Montreal gives him a job. He loses that job because of his drinking. And on page five, liquor ceased to be a luxury. It became a necessity. And at this point, you can see Bill beginning to acknowledge that he couldn't live without liquor, as opposed to liquor was fun and exhilarating. I'm not sure when I got to that point, or if I did, but there is a point at which you realize I'm kind of doomed here. I want to lose weight, or I want to gain weight, I want to sort of get rid of this big yoke on me, and yet I can't. And this and things get worse. Other things are bad. He gets a promising... Oh, I just wanted to read to you. This is... actually, it's hard to read this without getting very emotional. It's a letter that Lois kicks him out of the house at one point in 1929. And she says, I have to do this for your own sake. If you can quit for 7 days, I'll take you back. You know. It's very emotional. I'll pass it around. It's hard to read. It's hard for me to read without getting emotional about it. He writes a letter to her, which was torn up and then taped back together, talking about all the things I want, all the people I love, and what's on the other side. Not liquor or tobacco, but rather my baser self. So anyway, I'll pass this around if anyone wants to. I'll start over here. Pretty emotional stuff. But he couldn't do it. He couldn't stop drinking. This is 1929. He gets a business opportunity. If he doesn't drink until the contract is signed, he will become the president of a company. And here's a story. It's not in this book. It's in his biography or his writing, his own book, a brilliant book called Alcoholics Anonymous Comes of Age. Brilliant, brilliant book he wrote. It's how AA developed, but it's more than that. It's a very spiritual book.
And we have it here.
Oh, we have it here. And it's OA approved literature. And it's a brilliant book. Anyway, he talks about being in this hotel room 3 days away from having the contract signed. And he's with his business associates. And a guy brings out a jug. It's prohibition time. And he says, boys, I've got some Tennessee Applejack whiskey here. Let's have a drink. Comes around to Bill. Oh, I'm not drinking. Goes around the second time. I'm not drinking. Goes around the third time. And whoever brought it says, you know, Bill, you can't get this in this state. This is only from Tennessee. Oh, okay. And he starts to drink. And he loses everything. I mean, and he talks about, I had a business opportunity and I couldn't do it. I went on a prodigious bender and that chance vanished. There are other stories, and this is one of my favorites. He quits drinking for a while. He goes to the the town's hospital. He meets with Dr. Silkworth. He dries out, and Dr. Silkworth says to him, you have an allergy of the body. You cannot have so much as one drink without your body wanting more. It's a revelation to him. And he stops drinking for a while. And Armistice Day of 1934, so that's November the 11th, or Veterans Day, I don't know what you call it. We call it Remembrance Day in Canada, but I think it's Veterans Day for you guys. He decides he's going to go golfing on Staten Island. And he lives in Brooklyn. There's a bus, I guess, I don't know, that went from Brooklyn to Manhattan, and then from Manhattan all the way down to Staten Island. So he gets on this bus, and the bus breaks down. And on the bus, he meets a guy who's going to a gun range. He's golfing. The guy is going to on a gun range just to, you know, practice with his arms. And he's going to Staten Island as well. So they strike up a little friendship. And the bus breaks down. They're told there'll be another bus in an hour. So they go to a bar. And the guy orders a beer. And Bill orders a, I don't know, ginger ale or something. Oh, you don't want a beer? Oh, no, he says, I can't drink. He starts to tell his story about drinking, all of his drinking stories, all that Dr. Silkworth had told him. I can't have so much as one drink. Man's very impressed in that hour. Then they get on the bus, they get to Staten Island, and it's noonish or something, and the guy says, you know, before we break up, let's go for lunch. And then I'll go to my gun range and you'll go golfing. And the only place open at the golf course was a bar. They go to the bar, order their food. And the bartender comes up to them and says, "Boys, it's Armistice Day. Have one on me." And he plunks two beers, one beer in front of the other guy, one beer in front, and Bill drinks it. The guy said, "You just spent 3 hours telling me how you can't have so much as one. You must be crazy." Bill says, "Yes, I am." And you know, if you ever see the wonderful movie called My Name is Bill W. with James Woods and James Garner, it's a beautiful movie. That is sort of, that scene is there. And he comes home and he has no golf clubs and he's drunk and he's climbing up the stairs and stuff. And at page 6, remember, he knows Dr. Silkworth's. He says, "The remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable." Oh, I told that story out of order. Actually, he tells it on page 7. But anyway, "The courage to do battle was not there. My brain raced uncontrollably. There was a terrible sense of impending calamity." He does this for 2 years. He needs this drink. He takes his mattress down to the main floor because he's worrying about committing suicide. Then he goes to the town's hospital. And on page 7, he says, "Best of all, I met a kind doctor who explained," this is the second paragraph, end of the second paragraph, "I met a kind doctor who explained that though certainly selfish and foolish, I had been seriously ill, bodily and mentally. It relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hopes," one of my favorite sentences for reasons that if you were there last night you would remember, "for 3 or 4 months the goose hung high. I went to town and made a little money, then I fell off again," and that's the Armistice Day. And then he went back to the town's hospital, and Dr. Silkworth told Lois, he was on the second floor, Dr. Silkworth told Lois on the main floor, "He's doomed. There's nothing that I can do to help him. Either he's going to end up dying of a wet brain, or he's going to have to be locked up." And he says, page 7, "They did not," right at the bottom, "they did not need to tell me. I knew and almost welcomed the idea. It was a devastating blow to my pride. I, who had thought so well of myself and my abilities," it goes on, next paragraph, "no words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass, swamp of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my my match. I'd been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master." Because he finally understood, I can't stop from starting. I can't stop once I've started, and I cannot stop from starting. And I'm now in this vicious circle. Dr. Silkworth had isolated for him the core of his problem, and he couldn't do anything about it. Dr. Silkworth had no cure. There's nothing he could do. Armistice Day, page 8. Anyway, I thought the story was a little mixed up. But anyway, November 1934. He's sitting in his house, and here's where the violins start to tremolo, a little tremolo here. Because he's alone, his wife is at work, and the telephone rings. And it's Ebby. His old friend, Ebby Thatcher. I'll talk more about Ebby later on. But on page 9, he wanted to come over. He was sober. Well, he thinks, I'll fix that. You know, but I'd love to see Ebby. We can talk about all the great times we had together. I mean, I'll talk about Ebby a little bit later. Page 9, first full paragraph. "The door opened and he stood there fresh-skinned and glowing. There was something about his eyes. He was inexplicably different. What had happened? I pushed a drink across the table. He refused it. According to AA Comes of Age, he said, I'm not drinking. Disappointed but curious, I wondered what had gotten to the fellow. He wasn't himself." And here's truly my favorite sentence in the big book, because this is how Bill talked. "Come, what's all this about?" I queried. If the language doesn't put you off, you know, because who talks like that, right? But this is how Bill talked. And Ebby said, "I've got religion." Now, we'll find out when we get to step 12 that this was not quite the right thing to say. Because it wasn't religion. It was something else. But Ebby, I'll talk about Ebby in a minute, but Ebby says at a certain point, you don't, it doesn't have to be religion, it could be your own conception of God. And Bill then, at that moment, and you'll find this on page 12, that statement hits him hard. If it's his own conception, he can handle that. That hope, there's the hope. He can have what Ebby has. And that's step two. Okay. And then, if you're interested, on page 13, he goes back into the town's hospital, and he does steps 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and half of 9. He's halfway through step 9. By making amends to his wife. And suddenly he has this incredible spiritual experience. He's, you know, what is it? He's on a... I felt lifted up on page 14 as though the great clean wind of a mountaintop blew through and through. God comes to most men gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound. And this suddenness is something that we'll be dealing with later on in the next few chapters, because they realized all the pictures that they gave in the original edition of the Big Book were these sudden moments of conversion, whereas most people had slow and steady educational experiences that changed them, transformed them. But anyway, he calls on Dr. Silkworth and says, am I nuts? And here's one of those great moments, and the great speaker Clancy has this great talk on moments by which the future of AA were hanging by, the future was hanging by a thread. And this is one of the first great moments. And he says to Silkworth, this is what's happened to me. I don't feel like drinking. I feel God, the presence of God. Am I crazy? And he had been sober for 3 days. He'd been drying out for 3 days. And Dr. Silkworth could easily have said, well, you're still feeling the effects. You're feeling dementia, you know, or whatever it is.
Delirium
tremens, yeah. And you're in the pink cloud. It doesn't mean anything. It'll pass. But instead, he said, something has happened to you I don't understand, but you'd better hang on to it. Anything is better than the way you were. And that humility that Dr. Silkworth had gave Bill the courage and the hope to go on. Let's turn to page 17. This first page is really important, and Joe and Charlie do a marvelous explication of this. We of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill. Nearly all have recovered. They're using the phrase have recovered, or rather than in recovery or are recovering. Why do they do that? Because they have the faith in their higher power and in the vigor with which they pursue their steps 10, 11, and 12. They have that faith to know that they are different from what they used to be. And that, God willing, they will continue to be different from what they used to be. And that's why they use the word have recovered. It's a shocking word. It's a shocking word not only in OA, but it's a shocking word in AA. I didn't realize that, but Blaine, this mentor of mine, he wasn't a mentor, but this guy who taught me so much, who's an AA member, he did an incredible workshop for OA. And I asked him, I said to him, it must be nice to be in AA where you can use the word recovered and people don't bother you. He said, are you kidding me? I'm beaten up every time I use that word. But the Big Book uses it only. The word recovering is only in there for someone to describe in the chapter to the wives, a person who's sort of beginning a journey in the steps. And if they go on, we're average Americans, we are people who normally would not mix. That's sure true. I mean, the people I've met in this program, I would never have met them elsewhere. And as a matter of fact, that's generally proved. I live in a town of 750,000 people. I rarely see, in the things I do, people in OA. I just don't see them. We normally do not mix. They talk about we're like the passengers of a great ship liner, you know, after the catastrophe is over. Joyousness and democracy are there, from steerage to captain's table. And then they go on to say this, unlike the feelings of the ship's passengers, however, our joy in escape from disaster does not subside as we go our individual ways. The feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element in the powerful cement that binds us. But that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. Last paragraph on that page, page 17. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. the steps. Okay, remember I told you I would be saying that occasionally. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news, the common solution this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. That's what brings us together, not the problem, but the solution. We have to remember that. There's lots of great stuff in this chapter. I'm just going to go through it relatively quickly. Page 20. Right at the top, you may already have asked yourself why it is that all of us became so very ill from drinking. Doubtless you discover how and why, in the face of expert opinion to the contrary, we have recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body. Okay, this is in a nutshell a description that is still something that doctors and psychiatrists would not agree on from a scientific point of view. But we're not scientists, we're not doctors, we are people who are suffering and look for a solution. And this makes sense. A, we've recovered, and B, the problem is mental and physical. Well, what do I have to do? It's the purpose of the book to answer such questions specifically. We shall tell you what we have done. Learn from our experience. They talk about what people say. Why don't you drink like a gentleman or quit? You can't handle your liquor. Why don't you try beer and wine instead of whiskey? Lay off the hard stuff. You know, he could stop if he wanted to. She's such a sweet girl. Why wouldn't he do it for her sake? They don't understand us. They don't understand us. And now they're beginning to define, on the bottom of page 20, the real alcoholic. That is the alcoholic to whom this book will appeal. And they distinguish in that between the moderate drinker and the heavy drinker, and the alcoholic. There's moderate drinker, they can give it up if they have good reason for it. Then we have a certain type of hard drinker, he may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally, it may cause him to die, but if there's a sufficiently strong reason, he can stop, or even moderate. And you know, I use this as an example all the time. My daughter went to a residential college, a liberal arts college in Canada, and on the East Coast, and she's not a drinker, but she lived in a residence, and almost everyone in the residence, it was the first time they've been able to drink. Their drinking age was lower in this province she was in, and every weekend, all of her classmates, all of her roommates, but the people who lived on her floor, would get nauseatingly drunk, sometimes literally nauseatingly drunk. The place had no traffic, no one traffic light, and everyone walked everywhere, so she was a designated walker. That's a joke. But anyway, none of those people turned into alcoholics. They were just really heavy drinkers. Matter of fact, in their sophomore year, they didn't drink as much, right? So if everyone who drank excessively and binge drank were considered to be an alcoholic, and I guess they would be by some definitions at the time they were drinking, but those people didn't need the 12 steps. They did not have the problem. And the big book goes on, page 21. What about the real alcoholic? He may start off as a moderate drinker. He may or may not become a continuous hard drinker. So even a moderate drinker can be a compulsive eater. But at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. That's the allergy of the body. That's the whole concept that you have this abnormal mind that you just can't stay away from it. Abnormal body. It's interesting. I was in Sweden and went to an OA meeting and met some people. And if you want to talk stereotype, there were at this meeting some stereotypical Swedish women. You know, the blondes, the people who have sort of a freshness to them, thin. And I said to one of them, "How long have you been in OA?" Thinking, you know, well, 5 years and I've lost all my weight. She said, a month. I said, well, it doesn't look as if you have a lot of weight to lose. Were you bulimic? Were you anorexic? Oh, no. I'm coming because I'm addicted to food. I said, most people would not see that in you. She said, well, in Sweden, we are fit. We are very fitness conscious. And we know that if we can't take off 10 pounds or 20 pounds, if we still can't do it after we try best to do it, we've got a real problem. Wow. So these were what we would call moderate eaters who acknowledged that they had this problem. Sometimes it takes 100 or 200 pounds for us to acknowledge that we have that problem. And as I told you, the guy who got me into OA, who was an AA, had been a gutter drunk, he saved me 100 pounds. I would not have thought I had this problem until the time he told me that I should take my food as seriously as he took his alcohol. So I came into this program really fat, but not morbidly obese. But I know that if he hadn't made that intervention with me, I would have been morbidly obese before I joined the program. So the big book says the test of the real alcoholic is whether or not he or she can stop once he or she has started. And then they'll go on and give you another test in a little while, but I just wanted to point that out.